Now, Associate Professor Carrie Leonetti from Auckland Law School says there's broad support for strengthening sexual consent laws, but questions why the government, as Russell did, is waiting until after the election when the changes may already have enough support to pass in Parliament. Thanks for joining us on the program once again, Carrie. It's always neat to have a cordial with you. Tēnā koe.
Morena, Dale.
The affirmative consent laws, National, are promising that they will look at it then if re-elected. Why do you believe these reforms are important, Carrie, and what difference could they make in practice?
So it is a defence to a charge of rape if the defendant reasonably but mistakenly believed that the complainant consented. So if there's essentially a reasonable misunderstanding where the complainant doesn't want to have the sexual activity, but it happens anyway because the defendant thinks that the complainant consented. And what sort of causes a lot of problems in practice in trying these cases is, when is it reasonable for a defendant to think someone is consenting to sex when they're not? And so right now in New Zealand, our statute sort of defines a bunch of things that aren't consent, or a bunch of situations where someone isn't consenting. So if they're unconscious, if they're intoxicated, but it doesn't actually have any affirmative assent requirement. It doesn't require, in order for a mistake about consent to be reasonable, that the defendant took steps and had some affirmative reason to believe that the victim wanted to have the sexual activity. And in a lot of situations, while I think people have a stereotype that rape victims will sort of kick and fight and resist and scream, and while our statute does not require that, the reality is a lot of victims just kind of go dead, just sort of freeze like a deer in the headlights. And I think most of us think it wouldn't be reasonable to think that somebody who was frozen in panic was consenting, but we just don't currently require, as a condition of having a reasonable mistake of fact defense, a reasonable mistake of consent defense, that the defendant sort of take any steps to make sure that the person is consenting and not just panicked and acquiescing.
Yeah, it is a very difficult situation to resolve, I'd suggest. But even so, the ongoing trauma caused when someone is caught up in this should never be understated as well. The issue of those charged and their right to silence, is this something that needs to be addressed? How does this interplay with this proposed legislative change, Carrie?
So I think, as a practical matter, any time a defendant is going to claim consent, let alone mistaken belief, like genuine mistaken belief in consent, they're almost always, as a practical matter, going to have to testify. I mean, of course, people have a right to remain silent, but tactically, it would be hard for a defendant to say, I thought the person was consenting when they weren't, without saying that, taking the witness stand and saying that to the jury. And so in most of these cases right now, the complainant will testify, and I'm going to gender this, although obviously it's not always gendered this way, but the complainant will testify, I did not want that sexual activity to happen. And the defendant will testify, well, I actually thought that she did. And in fact, a lot of these mistaken belief in consent cases arise where there's a pre-existing intimate relationship between the people. So the person says, well, the person 100 other times, I just assumed they wanted to do it on 101st. And the jury has to decide if that's reasonable. So I don't think this significantly changes the calculus about whether the defendant testifies or not. It probably will shift subtly the subject matter of cross-examination, both of the complainant and of the defendant. Because right now, cross-examination, sort of complainants get grilled about what they did to communicate the lack of consent. How was the defendant supposed to know they didn't want to have sex this time? And I think this will shift the conversation to more focus on the cross-examination of the defendant, which is, what steps did you take to make sure the person did want to have sex? So I think it'll just sort of shift the focus of some of the evidence at the trial.
Thank you. Carrie Leonetti is an associate professor at the law school here at Auckland. You've suggested there may already be enough cross-party support for these changes. Why do you think the government's waiting till after the election rather than acting now, Carrie?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert in political science, but it does seem a bit odd to me. It's my understanding there's been a Labour proposal for affirmative consent for quite some time, and that the national-led government opposed it and wouldn't participate in it. And it does seem a bit odd to me that the government that's in power is campaigning on what they would do if they were reelected, when all evidence seems to suggest they could do it right now. I mean, I don't see any reason why tomorrow the labor bill or the labor greens bill for affirmative consent couldn't be introduced in parliament with even the backing of half of the members of National or half of the members of the majority coalition in government. I would think it would pass instantly. So it is odd to campaign to promise to do something, you know, next year that they can do today, because they are in fact the government that's in power right now. I mean, that part is a bit baffling.
You've also said that the legal drafting will be challenging. What are the biggest legal hurdles in introducing an affirmative consent model in this country?
So this is one of the things I've wondered about, is it that there's actually a disagreement between the Labour and Greens Party and the national-led government about what the statute should actually say? I mean, most other countries that have done this, probably the closest model for us in terms of law would be the Australian states that have done this. They just simply said, you know, in order to have a reasonable mistake of consent defense, the victim has to have given an affirmative voluntary consent. It doesn't have to be words. It can be actions. These things can be subtle. But that it's pretty simple. I mean, usually this is like one sentence, really, that would get added into the Crimes Act to just say consent means affirmative voluntary consent. And it has to be given. It has to be indicated in some way in either words or actions. It's hard for me to see what the drafting disagreement would be. But that's the piece I wonder about is, I mean, we're basing this right now on basically press releases from the National Party. So I'm looking at what they claim they want to do. It looks identical to me to what the current Labour-sponsored bill would do. But is there some other drafting challenge they're worried about? In some ways, the harder part about these affirmative consent laws is how you direct the jury. This actually changes what the jury is told in assessing a reasonable mistake of consent defense. And so that might be the challenge. I mean, you don't have to put jury directions into your law, but we typically do put specialized jury directions in the Evidence Act for stuff like this. So I'm not really sure. I don't really understand why National walked out on the negotiations and why they don't like the labor-based bill. But it may be that the precise words there's actually a real disagreement over the precise words. And if that's the case, I'd just rather hear it. I'd rather hear the national government say, if we're elected, we'll introduce this, but it won't look like the labor bill. It'll look different. We're going to slightly change this, like what would be sufficient to constitute affirmative consent. Because I think that's important information for voters to have in deciding which party to vote for is, you know, what is their specific affirmative consent proposal going to look like?
Yeah, tēnā koe. I spoke earlier in the program with Russell Smith from Tuahaki Ahine. That's the National Network Ending Sexual Violence Together. He highlighted the disproportionate impact of sexual violence on Māori. So it is an issue that we need to be across and understand what the drivers of changes might be. You did touch on as well, Carrie, about states in Australia that have introduced laws of this type. Are you au fait with how they have worked?
You know, it's really hard to measure effectiveness in this area because such a tiny percentage of sexual assaults ever go to trial. Fewer than 1% of rapes that actually happen result in a conviction. I mean, you would hope that this would increase both the reporting rate. So fewer than 10% of victims ever report sexual assaults to the police at all, and then fewer than 10% of the reports actually result in a conviction. So you'd hope that this would increase reporting rates. And I think a lot of victims of sexual assault are fully aware that going through the trial process can be incredibly brutal. And so if they knew that the trial was not going to focus on them not doing a good enough job of saying no, but on the defendant not doing a good enough job of ascertaining yes, that might make it easier for victims to go to the police. And it should make it easier in these difficult cases for the police and prosecutors to convict. So my hope would be you'd see, I mean, this is a weird thing to say, but I'd actually like to see an increase in reports and an increase in convictions, because we know we're just not getting almost all of the cases right now. But because the numbers are so small, it's really hard to know, for instance, if the reforms in Australia have worked, because you might be talking about the difference between a 0.09% conviction rate and a 1.1% conviction. I mean, it just isn't going to make enough of a difference, I don't think, in the numbers to detect a clear effectiveness change. Over time, I expect to see studies where victims are talked to about their sort of the process of going through trial. And one of the things I would hope a victim would say is that they felt less traumatized and brutalized and sort of scrutinized as these trials went on, because the burden had sort of suddenly subtly shifted off of the victim to prove that they said enough of a no, and onto the defendant to make sure that they got enough of a yes.
Now, traumatized, particularly Wahine, caught up in this sort of discussion and court cases. You know, if there were more votes in the sector, I'm sure it would have been prioritized. But sadly, turning our back somewhat on the plight of those who go before the courts under such situations. Again, a reminder of just how difficult it is. And with so few reported and convicted, we can understand why. Just finally, what would or what should lawmakers be most mindful of, Carrie, to ensure any new consent law protects victims while remaining clear and workable in the courts?
I mean, I actually think a lot of this is going to turn on training. We often see with the criminal justice system, you'll see a change in the statute, but no change in practice. I mean, so it's not just that these courts, these sort of court procedures often focus around this question to victims about, well, did you really do enough to say no? I think we see a lot of prejudice around that in police and in prosecutors. And so part of this has to be training. Like, the police need to stop asking victims, you know, how loudly they said no. There's a lot of prejudice around rape within existing intimate relationships. This idea that if you consented a bunch of times, of course the person reasonably thought you consented on this particular occasion. And so I think it's more the reactions of the justice system actors. So that's my hope for any sort of affirmative consent law change. It's not so much that the law changes, it's that by changing the law, we're hopefully working on attitudes. We're hopefully encouraging the people in the justice system to stop putting so much pressure on victims to justify why we should believe they said no or didn't say yes, and put a little more pressure on people who have sexual activity to explain why they thought they had a yes. Because in these cases, everybody is agreeing that the victim did not consent to the sexual activity. It's just a question of whether they did a good enough job of resisting or whether the defendant did a good enough job of making sure this was what they wanted to happen. So I'm hoping this will shift attitudes around that, that we just need to stop demanding that victims prove to us that they said a clear enough no, and make people who have sexual activity with people who are in fact not consenting to the sexual activity took enough effort to make sure that the person actually wanted to do what they were doing. I feel like our kids at school get trained on this stuff all the time. It's people my age, it's older people that I think harbor a lot of these myths that, you know, if somebody just sort of lies there and puts up with the sexual activity with an existing partner, that that's somehow acceptable. I'm hoping that the law will work on those attitudes, will kind of affect those attitudes. But that takes training and that takes awareness.
Tēnā koe, thank you for giving us an overview. It's not something a lot of us consider in our day-to-day lives, but it is important because it does impact a lot of our people that we are across these proposed changes. Associate Professor Carrie Leonetti from Auckland Law School with us, offering some perspectives on that kaupapa of affirmative or not issues, affirmative consent law reform. Thanks so much for joining us again, Carrie. I look forward to another cordial soon. Ngā mihi.
My pleasure.
Tēnā koe, thank you.